So, here we are. I think as most of you know, our theme for this month has been the topic of right view. And so in my talk tonight, I'm going to carry on with that theme, but maybe just approaching it from a slightly different angle, although I think every talk on it has approached it from a slightly different angle. But the title of my talk tonight is I See You, Mara. So I'm hoping this will be kind of a complementary take on right view that emphasizes a little bit more not what right view is itself, but more recognizing those times when right view is not present and we're caught in delusion instead. And the poem or excerpt from the sutra that I read at the end of the sitting is kind of a reminder that things aren't always the way that they seem when we look at them from our habitual viewpoints or conventional views. Actually, they may be quite different from this perspective of right view. So it's important for us to notice that. It's probably a good idea to start off the talk tonight with a bit of a reminder about what right view is, or wise view, or right or wise understanding, as it's also sometimes called. Maybe one phrasing, you know, works better for you than another. I know some people prefer wise view to right view, because right view makes them think more of, you know, black and white, either or, this kind of feeling, whereas wise view doesn't give that kind of sense. So I know at the beginning of this year, when Tweri and Tim were going to start teaching this topic, they made up some little, like, charts or cards. I think they had them out at the beginning of the year, but I haven't seen them for a while, that had a summary of the Four Noble Truths and the different elements of the Eightfold Path. And on this chart, it had a nice definition of right view, which was viewing reality as it is, not just as it appears to be, by seeing the impermanent, unsatisfactory, and non-personal nature of experience. And I think that's a pretty good definition of what right view is. And also, as Tweri talked about in the last couple of weeks, right view also has a component that includes some understanding of the laws of karma, or just recognizing that when we don't see things or don't act out of the framework of right view, when we take what is impermanent as permanent, when we take that which is really ultimately not going to be satisfying as something that's going to bring us lasting satisfaction forever, when we take that which is impersonal as me or mine, sooner or later suffering will inevitably follow. Another way to think of this is that when we see things from the perspective of right view, we understand the first three noble truths. So we see the first noble truth, we recognize the truth of dukkha, we see the other two of these three characteristics of impermanence and non-self or anatta, and we also have some understanding of what causes dukkha or suffering and what leads to the cessation of suffering. Because we see that when we act out of delusion, confusion, greed, aversion, sooner or later, we're not going to be in a very happy place. Whereas if we act out of wisdom, clarity, generosity, kindness, freedom from suffering will follow. But, of course, this kind of understanding isn't always there. And certainly, when we first start practicing, there's a lot that we don't understand, and we don't necessarily have right view. For example, we might listen to the teachings and be able to accept, at least on an intellectual level, that things are impermanent and never completely satisfactory. But when it comes to this anatta or not self, we may feel like, I don't get this at all. I'm totally at sea. And, you know, that's a fine and totally normal kind of way to feel, because it takes time to see these things clearly. In fact, you know, it's, I think most of us who've been practicing for a while would feel that it's a lifetime project to see these things as deeply as they can really be understood. And even when we do have some understanding, still, we forget, we get fooled, we fall back into old habits of mind. It happens pretty often. And I doubt if anyone would say, oh, no, 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 not me. I think we can all agree. Yeah, it happens pretty often. In fact, we get caught in delusion and confusion and wrong view so often that in the Buddhist tradition, there's a legend of a demon that's always whispering in our ear, trying to fool us into believing things that aren't really true and aren't really right view. And some of you may recognize the name of this demon, Mara. And so I'd like to start the talk today with a story about Mara and his visit to the Buddha on the evening of his enlightenment. Now, a lot of the time we feel as if we're the only ones who get visited by this demon of delusion, but not so, not so at all. In fact, according to legend, he spent a lot of time pestering the Buddha too. Now, I think we have understand from the legends of the Buddha that he started out life being of noble birth, living in a palace with all the refinements and pleasures of life. But he ventured out and he saw for himself aging, sickness, and death. He really saw this problem of human suffering, and it touched him so deeply that he was moved to try to seek an answer to this problem of suffering. So he left his home, his position, his family, took up the life of a wandering ascetic, tried all kinds of different practices, none of which really gave him the answer that he thought, sought. And so finally, he sat down under the Bodhi tree, determined not to move until he understood this mystery of suffering and found the way that one could be released. And so now Mara was not very happy to see him doing this. He was the prince of delusion and was upset to see that the Buddha was pursuing truth in this way and really seeking release and freedom from delusion. And if the Buddha succeeded, well, what's going to happen to Mara's power and influence? So he does everything he can to get the Buddha to try to give up his quest. He tries to tempt him, to frighten him, to threaten him. All kinds of tactics Mara had. He says to the Buddha, first, you know, what do you think you're doing here sitting like this? Don't you know that you've abandoned all of your duties to your family, to your position? You ought to get up right now and go back home and fulfill your obligations. But the Buddha had already considered all of these things. He knew he was doing what he had to do, so he shook his head and no. I see you, Mara, he said. And then Mara says to the Buddha, you know, here you are sitting here like this. You've abandoned all of the traditional practices of our religion, going off on your own in this weird way. You're straying from the right path. You don't even know what you're doing. But the Buddha had really considered this also very carefully and looked into all these traditions. He knew what he was doing. So he said, oh, no, 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 Mara, I see you. Then Mara tried to tempt the Buddha with power. And he says, you know, if you go back home, you could become a really great king. I mean, not just an ordinary run-of-the-mill garden variety king, but a great king, a universal king. You could establish this huge empire. Everybody could live in peace. And, you know, isn't that what you want? You want to do good things. In fact, You could even turn the Himalayas into gold and distribute that gold to everybody in your kingdom. No one would have to be poor. Don't you want to do those kind of things? I know that's, you know, that's what you're into. You should go back. You should do those. You can do this. But the Buddha saw through all of this. And he replied to Mara that even a single person's wants were so insatiable that two huge mountains of gold would never be enough to satisfy them. So no, forget it, Mara. Then Mara tried to seduce the Buddha with the thrills of sex and romance. And some of the stories say he even enlisted his two daughters to try to help him with this. But the Buddha saw that as pleasant as these things were, they weren't lasting, and he wasn't swayed from his goal. "I see you, Mara," he said. Then Mara tried to frighten the Buddha, appearing as a hideous demon and sending all these horrible, terrible army of nasty, frightening creatures. And they launched all these arrows at the Buddha, trying to hurt him, destroy him, scare him. But as the arrows approached him, they were transformed into flowers that just fell to the ground. So the Buddha wasn't harmed, the Buddha wasn't fooled. And then finally, Mara mocked the Buddha and told him, "You know, all of this work you're doing, this is for nothing. You can sit here and discover whatever you like, but what difference is it going to make?" says Mara. "You know, nobody's going to care, nobody's going to recognize you. And more than that, what right do you think you have even to do this, to solve these mysteries of existence?" And the Buddha responded by touching the earth and saying to Mara, "The earth itself will be my witness that I can know these things and that I have the right to know these things. Nature itself is my witness." And when he touched the earth, the ground trembled in agreement, and Mara had to admit that he was defeated, and he sulked off. But that didn't keep him from coming back every now and then to pester the Buddha and the Buddha's followers, as I think we know well. So you might notice in this story that the Buddha was quite acquainted with Mara and with all of Mara's arguments and temptations and talk. And he knew better than to really believe any of these things that Mara had to say. Whenever Mara would come with a temptation, he'd say, "Oh, Mara, I see you. I know this is delusion, and I know I shouldn't take these kinds of talk seriously because they're not helpful. They're not true." Well, we might not actually believe in a demon that tries to delude and confuse us. I think we're all quite familiar with these voices of delusion, confusion, and doubt in our own minds. Nothing unfamiliar here in all of the kinds of things that Mara was saying to the Buddha, I don't think. The question for us is, can we be as perceptive as the Buddha? Can we also see Mara? Can we see delusion when it comes to us with views and ideas that deep down we know that aren't true? Can we be perceptive enough to recognize when we're caught up in wrong view, when we're taking what's impermanent to be something permanent, taking something that's never really going to be completely satisfying as the one thing that's going to make us happy forever? Taking what is impersonal as me and mine, operating from a position of wanting something different from what's actually happening, from greed or craving, or from a position of aversion where we're wanting to get rid of whatever is happening. I think when we pay attention, at least I certainly know when I pay attention, I notice these kinds of attitudes arising pretty often, you know, in response to different occurrences in my daily life. And I expect you probably recognize these things too. Sometimes it's in response to a little thing, you know, getting way more upset than we really need to be because we get caught in traffic or the weather is bad when we'd planned to go hiking or something like that. Or maybe because one of our family members promised to, you know, pick up the milk at the store and they forget to do that, these kind of things. Or it might be something bigger. Being so obsessed with something, you know, maybe a romantic relationship, success in the job, whatever it is, so obsessed that we feel that if we can't have that thing, we can never be happy. Or even going on from that, and maybe even more painfully, we have this feeling that if we can't get that thing or do that thing, then we're a failure, then we're worthless. Or it may be being so attached to one of our roles, maybe as a parent, a worker, a spouse, whatever it might be, that when things begin to change, as, you know, inevitably they do begin to change, then we're totally thrown off and we feel like we can't change. We feel angry or threatened, or our whole sense of who we are is under attack. Or it often may be a situation where we simply refuse to see what is really happening. I think most of us know, and maybe some of us are, the person who puts off going to the doctor or the dentist. Not so much because they're so afraid, but they just kind of don't want to know if something might be wrong. Or the person that ignores their budget and won't look at their bank account because they just don't want to think about it, that kind of thing. You know, if I don't know, it's not a problem, that kind of feeling. A couple of weeks ago, at the Sunday sit, I told a little story from the Jataka Tales that gives a nice illustration of wrong view and how it can operate in our lives. So I thought I would share it with you tonight, just because sometimes, like a story, well, if I hear a story, sometimes I'll remember the story and remember the lesson of the story when I might not remember just the words in the regular talk. So I will offer this story to you in a kind of abbreviated version. The name of the story is The Tortoise That Loved His Home Too Much. So once upon a time in a land far, far away, there was a big lake close to a great river. And when there was a lot of water, the river and the lake were one, and the river fed the lake. But when the water was low, then the lake would become isolated. So in times when there was a lot of drought and the lake was separate from the river, there was no water coming into it, and it could dry up. And there were a lot of fish living in the lake, and tortoises living in the lake. And most of the time they were pretty smart about their surroundings, and they had a good idea of when there might be a drought and they might need to do something. And usually when they knew there was going to be a drought, they could sense this and swim out of the lake into the river so they would be protected. But there was one tortoise that was very stubborn and would not go to the river because, he said, this is where I was born, this is where I grew up, this is my parents' home, I'm going to stay. And the other tortoises and fish warned him that this wasn't very wise, that there was probably going to be a drought coming pretty soon and the lake might dry up and he'd be stuck there. And his home would not be a very pleasant home at all. There might not be any food. He might starve. All kinds of bad things could happen. But the stubborn tortoise said, nope, this is my home. I'm not going to leave it. I'm the tortoise of the big lake. That's who I am. And I'm not leaving. And he went on to say, well, this was my parents' home. Now it's my home. It's always been that way. This is how it's always going to be. I'm not leaving. There's nothing wrong with this place. Nothing's going to happen to me. Everything's going to be fine, and I'm not going anywhere. No. So the others kept trying to argue with him, but he wouldn't budge. And finally, they gave up and left the tortoise and went into the river. And Yes, indeed, the drought came, the hot weather came. It was one of the hottest summers anyone could remember. And just as all of the other fish and turtles had feared, the water in the lake dried up. And so this tortoise that stayed behind, now he was pretty upset. He didn't think any of this could ever happen to him. His home was never going to change as far as he was concerned. It was always going to be fine. It was always going to be just the same. But it wasn't. There wasn't any water. So when that happened, he dug a hole and buried himself in the clay at the bottom, thinking he would be safe there. Quite a metaphor, I think. You know, the bad thing really happens. Bury yourself in the mud so you can't see it. But unfortunately for him, that wasn't a very safe place either, because this lake bottom was the perfect place for the potters who lived in the nearby village to get clay to make pots. So one day, one of the potters came along, dug deep down into the lake bottom with a big, sharp spade, and scooped up this turtle, thinking he was a lump of clay. But it was this turtle, and the turtle was, oh my gosh, here I am, I'm dying because I was too fond of my home, too stubborn to leave it. I couldn't believe it could ever change. Now, in the version of this story that I told on Sunday, because there were several small children, you know, I modified it a little bit, and in that version, the potter took the tortoise back to the village, and he was able to revive it, and the tortoise told everybody how foolish he had been and warned them not to make his mistake. But the original Jataka tale is a bit darker in that version. The potter rams the tortoise's shell with his sharp spade, and so the tortoise dies. But not before exclaiming in verse to all who would listen how foolish he was and warning them not to make the mistakes that he made. So, you know, in this story, you know, it really does show how the tortoise, whether, you know, we use the kind of more comforting version where he lived, or the original version where he got killed, he got into a lot of trouble because he didn't have wise view. He thought his happy home would never change, so he didn't understand impermanence. He couldn't understand the truth of dukkha because he couldn't believe that this bad thing was really going to happen. And because he felt that even if everybody else might leave, he couldn't, because it was his ancestral place and he was the tortoise of the lake. This place was me, was him, was what he was. He couldn't recognize the anatta characteristic of our experience either, that we're not our position or our possessions, and that we can be separated from these things just like anybody else, if that's the way conditions are. So the tale of the tortoise is something to think about. You know, how often do we find ourselves reacting to circumstances like he did? And if I, you know, consider myself, you know, I'm not so different from that tortoise a lot of times. So I'm hoping that every now and then when I start to get caught up in his ideas, I'll remember him and maybe recognize a little bit sooner than I might otherwise recognize that, you know, I'm being too attached, I'm being blind to the facts that things change, or that I'm burying my head in the mud when it would be better to actually look and see clearly what's going on. So we can see delusion at work in our everyday lives when we have these kind of attitudes like the tortoise had. But we can also sometimes recognize these forces of delusion in our spiritual practice. And, you know, it's kind of curious, but one of the things that I've noticed for myself is that sometimes in our spiritual practice, that's the place where it's hardest of all to see delusion clearly. You know, maybe it's because we have some idea that, You know, in our everyday life, we expect things to go wrong, or we expect to get upset or get angry or, you know, have ideas that aren't quite right, and we need to be on the lookout and notice these things. But when it comes to our spiritual life, we may have this idea that this ought to be the refuge from all of that, so it always ought to be wonderful and beautiful and happy and peaceful and so on and so forth. Forgetting that, you know, our experience in meditation is like any other experience, it's also subject to these three characteristics of dukkha, anicca, and anatta. And in fact, you know, a lot of times it's actually in our meditation practice on the cushion when we start to recognize these three characteristics most clearly, because when we're meditating, we're kind of sitting there stuck, and when they come up, you know, we can't really run away or distract ourselves. We're there. They're there for us to see. So, but still, we don't necessarily recognize this kind of delusion. And, you know, just like the Buddha, Mara may come to us and tell us for one reason or another that our practice isn't worthwhile. You know, maybe the story is, oh, meditation is all very well, but I really don't have time right now. I have to focus on my career or my family, whatever. Or maybe the story that, oh, well, what's really going to make me happy is finding that perfect love relationship. And, you know, the Buddhism, it's all about, you know, non-attachment and all that. It doesn't fit in with what I really want. Or maybe the story is that, you know, meditation isn't really the answer. If we want change in the world, we really have to focus on social activism. And of course, you notice too, all of these stories are very black and white. They don't take into account the possibility that maybe we can have our meditation practice and also lead a full life that includes these other things. But, you know, that's the way delusion is. It's not necessarily quite clear and quite correct. Or often more commonly, the story is something about this meditation isn't working. Things aren't going the way that they should. You know, we may feel like, well, you know, my mind ought to be really calm and quiet, but there's all these distracting thoughts. Or we might feel like my body should be comfortable and relaxed, but it's painful. Even after all these years, I still have those meat hooks in the shoulders. Why? Or we feel like, oh, I should be peaceful. I should feel happy and calm, but I feel agitated and restless. Or we might think, oh, I should be having some kind of blissful experience, some altered state. I ought to be seeing the truth of non-self or the truth of impermanence, but nothing special is happening. What's wrong with me? You know, oddly enough, I don't think we ever say, oh, I ought to be seeing more of dukkha. But somehow, you know, we never really go there, you know. Although, of course, if we were paying attention, we'd realize that we're seeing that in spades. But, you know, who wants to welcome that? And finally, we often may begin to doubt our ability or worthiness to do the practice. You know, in the beginning, we may just feel like we don't understand what we're supposed to be doing. We can't get these techniques right. But this feeling of I can't do this can follow us long into our practice. Not that we can't do the specifics of meditation, but more a feeling of unworthiness of who am I to actually pursue this freedom, this awakening, you know, having a sense that, yeah, you know, a little relaxation is possible, I might understand myself a little better, but enlightenment, all of this other stuff, no, that's not for me, you know, this kind of feeling of only so much freedom is possible. Only so much understanding is possible. You know, enlightenment, who am I kidding? And that can be really kind of sap our energy to want to practice when we feel like that. And yet I think there's this kind of subtle sense of that. I think often, I know I feel that sometimes, and I think many of us probably feel like that sometimes. Well, you know, I can't quite do this. So it's important to recognize when these forces are at work in our practice. And I know one of the things I'm recognizing more and more, that usually when I'm getting discouraged, when I'm getting frustrated, when I'm feeling like nothing is going right and struggling with doubt, it's usually because there's some aspect of this wrong view at work in there. And one of the things that I've had to work with in my own practice consistently is this problem of having ideas and expectations of what the practice should be like, how it should be unfolding. You know, when I first started, I was always looking for something that was pleasant, you know, peace, calm, and so forth. And after a while, I started to understand that these states, you know, they come and go. And you can't expect experience always to be pleasant. But there still was this sense of looking for something, not necessarily pleasant, but at least something, you know, interesting or exciting, something worth paying attention to, maybe something I could see as progress, maybe a new understanding, new insight, something like that, you know, something should, this kind of something should be happening feeling. Not necessarily a pleasant thing, but something should be happening, you know. And when things didn't unfold in this way, I'd feel disappointed or stuck or like I wasn't getting anywhere. And, you know, over time, I've been able to understand more clearly that I can't control what can unfold and have more equanimity with these ups and downs. But I've often realized that the subtle sense of wanting something to happen is still there. And it can be really subtle. So subtle, you know, we don't even notice it. And yet, there it is. We don't really recognize it. And if that sense is there and we don't really recognize it, and these thoughts start to proliferate, pretty soon doubt begins to arise. And, you know, thinking, can I really do this? Is liberation possible for me? You know, have I really made any progress after all these years? Maybe this is as far as I'll be able to go. Any of this sound familiar to anybody? You know, yeah. And, you know, too, a lot of times these questions aren't right out in the open. It's not like the sense that I really, I really believe this, but kind of this subtle feeling of this that's kind of deep down where we may not. If somebody asked us, do you really think this? We'd say, oh, no, I know better. And yet that subtle feeling is in there. That place where we kind of barely recognize or admit that they're there. And of course, you know, when doubt is present, the motivation to practice isn't so great. If you know about the five faculties, you know that faith leads to energy. And so when faith is weak, energy is weak too. So it's kind of a syndrome, you know, getting caught up in these expectations, the story of the progress of our practice, and then disappointment that the progress isn't what we think it should be. In the end, it makes it really hard to practice. I remember several years ago, I was on retreat down at Spirit Rock, and I was going through some of this, and some of this stuff started to come up, and I went in for my interview, and Kamala Masters, who I think many of you may know, who's been one of my teachers for many years, she was one of the teachers at this retreat, and so I had my interview with her, and I started, you know, talking about this doubt, and so on and so forth, and discouragement, and she says, listen for a while, and then after a while she says, oh, that's delusion. That's delusion. And then she went on to say, you know, sometimes when these kinds of thoughts arise, you have to be very firm and just say, I see you, Mara. you know, emphasizing that need to just recognize that these ideas are coming out of this place of delusion and wrong view. Now, I'd like to say that with that advice, everything became crystal clear and no problem anymore. But, you know, as usual, not so. You know, I listened. I kind of took it in. But in the back of my mind, I was saying to myself, oh, but it isn't that simple. You don't understand. There really is a problem here, you know. So it took a while. But over time, I really been able to realize what good advice that was, and that the problem really was not so much anything that was, you know, happening, as the fact that there was this unrecognized delusion there and these assumptions that, you know, things should be going in a certain way. Assumptions that, you know, it's not going to change. If I don't understand something now, I never will. And just getting too identified with this story of my spiritual journey. So instead of actually seeing what was unfolding moment by moment, I was all caught up in this story of what ought to be happening. So, you know, not seeing the dukkha, not seeing the impermanence, and especially not seeing the anatta characteristic, and getting so identified with the story of my progress. So it was really good to get a better sense of that was what was going on. And it isn't so much that having these kind of thoughts are the problem, you know, because we all have them. I think, you know, we all have them. They come up for everybody, I'm sure. The real problems begin when they go unrecognized and we don't see what we're saying and take them as truth without really reflecting on the story that we're telling ourselves in our mind, or that, you know, we might say that Mara or delusion is telling us. And, you know, if we don't know or see that wrong view and delusion are operating, then we just rush right in immediately, get caught up in trying to solve the problem, find the solution, you know, running around trying to figure out what we're going to do, when a lot of times there isn't necessarily really a problem or really an answer to be found. The problem is more with this inaccurate view that we're taking of what's going on. So one of the things I know I'm doing in my practice is really just trying to recognize illusion when it's there, recognize doubt when it's there, and then just kind of stop, you know. Don't try to solve the problem. Don't try to figure it out. Just know that that delusion is present, that identification is present, that wanting is present, and be with that. And just being with that fact that that's there, you know, brings me back, brings us back to simply remembering, you know, the instructions to recognize the present moment and be with whatever occurs as it unfolds. And if we do that, then we can come back in balance. We're not caught in the delusion anymore. So in a way, it's like, you know, always remember, come back, come back, come back to what's happening in the moment. Finally, I'd like to end by just noting that while Mara is usually depicted in the Buddhist legends as a demon, we don't necessarily have to think of these forces of delusion and confusion as enemies or evil things that when we see we have to get rid of, or that we're bad for feeling these things, but to have a more compassionate view. And in fact, I think a lot of the times these subconscious habit patterns of, you know, delusion and, you know, seeing things in ways that aren't necessarily really the way they are more, you know, the mind's attempt to protect us from which something that seems too unfamiliar or too frightening or dangerous, but protecting us in ways that are not going to really be effective or very helpful in the long run and maybe aren't even necessary. And it's really natural for us to feel some fear and resistance when we're looking at the truths of dukkha, anicca, and anatta. You know, investigating dukkha is painful. We don't want to see it. Seeing impermanence is sad, you know. We have to confront loss of what we love and instability. That's frightening. And seeing this anatta, non-self characteristic too can be really frightening, since it can bring a sense of feeling that we're out of control, you know, the solidity we have with a strong sense of this is me, you know, not being quite there. I think most of us would rather feel that we're in control. If we can just get our act together, everything is going to be perfect forever, you know, happily ever after, just like in the fairy tales, even if we know it isn't true. You know, it's comforting in its way. So when delusion and confusion are there, we need to recognize them. It's really important to recognize them, but also meet them with compassion. Thich Nhat Hanh tells a beautiful story about Mara and the Buddha that kind of relates to this topic. So I'm going to share that with you. So according to this story of his, one day Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin and his very, very faithful and devoted attendant, one day Ananda was practicing walking meditation in front of the Buddha's hut. And he was doing his walking meditation, but his main purpose really was to protect the Buddha from all of these many, 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 many visitors and guests that were always trying to come in and talk to him. And of course, you know, fine, you know, people needed to visit the Buddha to talk to the Buddha, but he could easily just get overwhelmed by all of these people. So Ananda was kind of trying to run interference so there weren't too many people. And so he was kind of looking out, you know, seeing who was around. And he saw one guest coming from afar up over this hill. And he had the feeling that he recognized this person, but he wasn't quite sure who he was. But as the guests got closer and closer, he saw, oh, it's Mara. And so Ananda was, oh boy. He didn't feel very good about this. He felt pretty uncomfortable, thinking, well, what's Mara doing here? He doesn't have any business coming here and bothering the Buddha. But Mara was right up close. He saw Ananda. Ananda couldn't, you know, hide himself or pretend that, you know, no one was around. He had to greet the Mara and say hello to him politely. And then he kind of cut to the chase and says, well, Mara, what are you here for? What do you want? And Mara said, I want to visit the Buddha. I want to see him. And so Ananda was, he didn't like that. He didn't like that at all. It's like, this isn't good. I shouldn't let him bother the Buddha. So he says to Mara, well, Mara, why should the Buddha see you? Don't you remember all the trouble you caused for him in the old days when he was sitting under the Bodhi tree? You were just nothing but a source of trouble. You're always a source of trouble. You don't have any reason to see him, and more than that, I don't think he's even going to see you. You're an enemy of the Buddha. So Ananda was firm. But Mara, he's a pretty crafty character, and so he just stood there and looked at Ananda with a little smile on his face, and then he says, what's that you're saying, Ananda, that the Buddha has enemies? And then he started laughing, burst out laughing at this idea that the Buddha had enemies. Ananda was telling him the Buddha had all these enemies. And this confused Ananda so much that he didn't know what to do. And so he gave in and he said, well, okay, I'll announce that you're here. So he went in and he told the Buddha that Mara was there. thinking, well, of course, you know, the Buddha's not going to want to see him. He's going to say, oh, I don't have time to waste on Mara. I should just continue my meditation practice, tell him to go away. But to Ananda's surprise, the Buddha smiled and he says, oh, Mara is here. Oh, ask him to come in. And so Ananda had to go out and bow to Mara, invite him in. He didn't like that very much, but he did it. And then when Mara entered, the Buddha stood up and hugged Mara. And Ananda's like, what? This is, I don't get this. And then the Buddha pointed to the most comfortable spot in the hut and asked Mara to sit down. And then he turned to Ananda and says to him, Ananda, will you make tea for us? Ananda was like, But he went and made the tea, of course. You know, he would always do what the Buddha wanted him to do. And then he went back and he brought them the tea. And there the Buddha was, you know, looking kindly at Mara and saying, oh, Mara, how have you been? Is everything okay? And then they went on to talk. And Ananda was quite shocked by this, thinking, oh, isn't Mara the enemy? Aren't we supposed to just get rid of him? But the response of the Buddha to Mara really reflected the fact that in some ways Mara was actually helpful to the Buddha, because it was thanks to the difficulties, the temptations, all of these things that Mara brought with him, thanks to overcoming these things and understanding these things, that the Buddha was able to overcome his suffering and ignorance and become a fully enlightened being. So we too can appreciate the fact that, you know, these difficulties are something that we can learn from. And maybe think of, you know, our delusion when it comes as being not so much evil, but more like a confused friend who's trying to help us, but really doesn't understand the situation at all. So we can try our best to, you know, when these things come as they inevitably do, instead of reacting with aversion, to have some compassion for ourselves and some wisdom in understanding that, oh, here's an opportunity to learn. Learn more about what leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. Clearly recognizing delusion, but at the same time meeting it with compassion, the way the Buddha met Mara. So let's sit together for a few minutes. Letting the words fall away. And I'd like to end with a poem by Chi Chi that doesn't directly address right view, but I think is very much in line with it. What does the spring wind have in mind, coming day and night to these groves and gardens? It never asks who owns the peach and the damson trees, but blows away their crimson without a word. And now we have time for any questions or comments that anybody might have. So if feel free, if you have anything on your mind, maybe sharing something that has come up for you, or if you have a question to ask, that's great too.
I want to apologize in advance. I'm not sure if I can articulate what I would like to say. First of all, I want to thank you very much for being such an interesting talk. I wondered about demons in the Buddhist tradition. The Tibetan tradition, as I understand it, some people perceive it as projections. And I always thought the Buddha story, the story of the Bodhi tree and the demon, Mara, was a projection. Mara was a projection, not actually a demon. Even though projections can be solidified in our psyche, outside of ourselves. So I was especially appreciative of your theme of compassion towards, in my understanding, the emotions that you mentioned that give rise to all of the impediments that Mark represents. Kind of a befriending of these emotions that we have. And I think one of the things you said is that, if I understood you correctly, you said that one way of looking at it is that they were, that a lot of these delusion and confusion are efforts to protect us, arise from motivations, that's my understanding of the psyche, to protect us. So I just want to appreciate and acknowledge that. And,
yeah, thank you, Dean. Yeah, did everybody hear? Yeah, she was mentioning one thing, this sense that in the Tibetan tradition that these, you know, demons and stuff were considered as more as projections from the psyche, as representing our own emotions more than actual demons. And I think that is true in the understanding in the Theravada tradition too, that, you know, there's the legend of the demon, but the demon is really these projections from within. And in some of the readings I did, that the armies of Mara were described as, you know, like all of the hindrances, all of the types of delusion or wrong view that could come up. And certainly, you know, these are right there, you know, in us. So, yeah, it certainly is like to be interpreted as a metaphor, really, for forces within our own minds. And then also mentioning that importance of compassion when these come up and seeing them as protective mechanisms more than as forces of evil. So thank you. Yeah.
I think the alliance, at least in my own experience, that I might have with those forces is that it's a much healthier way for me to practice. Compassion, I think, is a wonderful way. I think of it as befriending. Mm-hmm. And the more befriending there is, the more knowledge there is.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's really true, that if I have an attitude of combativeness and aversion towards these things, I'm not going to look at them. I'm not going to understand them. But with an attitude of more of acceptance, then we can begin to look at them, experience them, see what's really going on. And, you know, too, that kind of aversive attitude often is a failure to recognize their impersonality, too. We're taking them as, oh, this is something bad in me that I need to get rid of or need to fix, rather than seeing, oh, these are these impersonal forces that come visit the mind when conditions are right. And it's a lot easier if you have this less personal view to look at these things and get close to them than if you're kind of caught in this feeling that this is this bad thing about me that I really don't want to have to admit or recognize, or else if I do recognize it, I'm just caught in feeling like I'm a horrible person, I'm terrible. So, yeah, this befriending allows us to learn more and know more, which we don't do when we see something as an enemy. So thank you, yeah. Did everybody hear she was saying that having that attitude of befriending lightens things up, so when these difficult emotions arise, as they inevitably do again and again, there isn't this sort of dread or fear, but more ability to be with them.
Yeah.
They're more welcoming.
Well, I think the Thich Nhat Hanh story added to the previous story is really quite inspiring to think that the Buddha was not necessarily purified of any doubt or delusion. Now, he must have been. I mean, he was enlightened, but in this, if he came, if he invited Mara in, he must have been witnessing Mara, the same forces that we witness, but everything depended on his, the way he met Mara. It wasn't that these forces were not there. It was that he met them in a way, in an enlightened way. So I often think, oh, there's that bad thing about me. I'll never, you know, go anywhere. It's going to be there forever. But it's not the thing itself. It's the way I meet that thing. And then it's not really Mara anymore.
Yeah.
So it's just, for me, it kind of gives me a better view. A writer view, if I keep that in mind.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, did people hear that? She was talking about the idea that, if I'm interpreting correctly, that the Buddha inviting Mara in, in a way it sort of implied that these forces of delusion could be there, but yet, because of the way he meant the forces of delusion, they were no longer a threat, no longer a problem. And so in us too, you know, we might see or feel these difficult emotions also, but if we meet them with understanding, they can't cause a problem, they can't harm us. It reminds me of one of the things the Dalai Lama said about when someone asked him about, you know, these, you know, hindrance, difficult emotions or anger or irritation on all of these kind of things that, oh, I bet you never feel that anymore. And the Dalai Lama sort of laughed and says, oh, no, you know, these things come. I feel they come to me too, but the difference is I'm not fooled by them. So it's kind of that sense that they might be there, but we see through them. We see through them. Yeah, so thank you. That's really nice. I hadn't really thought about that symbolism of the Buddha inviting Mara in. It was kind of funny. I didn't included in the talk, but there was more to this story where, funnily, you know, enough, the reason Mara came to visit the Buddha was because he had decided he was tired of being Mara because it was too hard to always have to be crafty and nobody really liked him. He wanted to be, he says, oh, Buddha, you know, everybody likes you. You get flowers and gifts. They all love you and praise you. Why don't we switch places for a while? And so then the Buddha told him, oh, Mara, well, you may think you want that, but you just don't know. It's pretty hard to be the Buddha. You think it's easy teaching the Dharma every day? So it was kind of funny, you know. But anyway, yeah, that's one. And I think perhaps any last comments or questions? Maybe this is a good time to have announcements. I know we have some announcements this evening.